Welcome to Truth Without Radio. Today's date is Friday the 25th of September 2020 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming live at RadioAlbion.com because normally we would have Dennis Wise here with us, but unfortunately he is ill. But I do have some good news. He is hoping to rejoin us again next week. He still has some health problems, but they are improving. He's hoping to do a podcast with us next week, and he's also hoping to do one with Radio Free South Africa. So that is some good news to begin the show with. And I also have some other good news. We have a special guest tonight, someone who's been a member of the chat room for quite some time now. He has lots of insights. I think he did a podcast with Zeiger a while back, a debating podcast with Zeiger, and he did an interview with William Fink for Christoginia, and he's here tonight to talk a little bit about some hidden aspects of Canadian history that we might not be aware of, but that we might find fairly interesting, rather like Okema's one that he did with us last week on Bulgarian history. So tonight we have Z the Cuckslayer with us. Z, good afternoon, sir. Good morning, I guess it is where you are. How are you doing anyway?
Pretty good. How's it going, Sven? Good to be here.
Yeah, very, very good. I'm glad you said that you would come on, because I really don't know much about Canadian history. It just seems to me it's a large country. I used to quite envy it. I used to think I would like to live in Canada because of all the wide open spaces, lots of mountains, lots of lakes, lots of forests. There's only three people every square kilometer. I mean, it's somewhere that you've got lots of space in. But then you look at the demographics and you see that it's only something like 70% white. And I was really shocked at that. I thought it was must be 95% white. And then over the last 10 years, I guess, it's become quite apparent that it's really, really quite cucked. I mean, before Justin Trudeau was there, there was problems with the free speech laws. There were quite a few famous people that got into trouble with that, Ernst Zundel being one of them. And now we see Justin Trudeau promoting liberalism and refugees are welcome here, and we've seen terrorism attacks there. But and that's about it. That's about all I know about Canada. Oh, and I know that part of it was French. We've got Quebec there, and half of the nation speaks French, which is, you know, that's pretty different all on its own, really, to have half the nation speaking one language and another half speaking the other. But anyway, yeah, tell us a bit about Canada then. Where do you want to begin?
Well, I guess in the earliest times, the early settlements would be a good place to start. People that are listening that may not be familiar with the geography of Canada might want to look at it while we're speaking, because it's so huge, and a lot of it overlaps. Canadian history overlaps with the U.S., of course, because they were both French, English colonies and mixed with French. So I guess we could start with Quebec, the founding of Quebec in 1534 by the explorer Jacques Cartier. And so he was a French explorer, came down the St. Lawrence River Valley and explored the entire area, had some small settlements. The first one, I believe, was just a few hundred people, but it didn't last. There was hostilities with the Indians and the brutal weather, I guess. Perhaps they weren't so prepared for it. But by 1608, the city of Quebec was established, and it was a walled city. It's high up on cliffs. I mean, it's not like they didn't come back till 1608, but that was the first major establishment of a major city. That was followed by Montreal in 1642. And really, there's three main groups in Canada. So that was the first one, the Quebec French. I'll get to the British last because they came last, right? There's another group of French people called the Acadians, who are on the East Coast to this day in small numbers, but they also settled the area in the early 1600s, so before the Mayflower, which was 1620. We're talking about 1605 or so. They settled Nova Scotia and what is now New Brunswick. And they were always considered a separate French colony from Quebec. But Quebec was really, it was called New France. All it was really called New France, but Quebec was one portion of it, a large portion. Acadia was the East Coast portion. And the British, of course, didn't arrive till, there was a colony, a very small one. It was one ship that arrived in Roanoke, Virginia. So Virginia, the state in the U.S. today, and that was 1590. However, that colony is called the Lost Colony of Roanoke because all of the people that went there completely disappeared. The ship had to go back because it was requisitioned for the Spanish Armada. And when it returned after that war with the Spaniards, everybody was gone. So that Lost Colony never, it's suspected that they were killed by the Indians. But really, they started coming around 1620, right? So about the same time, really, that Quebec and Acadia was established. The British were moving in, but they were moving in the 13 colonies, right? What became the 13 colonies. And they did very well. I mean, it was a tough place to live, all three of these groups. Very tough place to live. I mean, perhaps it was a little easier where it was warmer, but, you know, they cleared their land. They had a good life. They were very strong people.
Can I just interject there and say, I mean, it's quite amazing when you think that they were just left there on their own to start up a colony, and it was just a ship's worth of them, and the ship had gone off to go off and fight on the Armada. And you think about, you know, the hardiness and the courageousness and the spirit of adventure that these people had. And what is the actual land like there, the forest? Is it like Europe? Is it like Northern Europe in any way, or is it very different to that? I mean, was it not just that they were in a new land, but there was new vegetation and new animals, or was it in a way that it's a bit more similar to Europe in a way? Do you know? Just tell us a bit about the landscape.
I mean, tons of forest, right, in Quebec, what is now Ontario. All of North America, really, on the East Coast. It's a forested area. There were obviously new animals. There were some new crops. I think maize is a new crop. There are other New World crops. I'm not too familiar with them. But, you would say it's similar to Europe. I mean, it's definitely not similar to Africa or Australia or South America. You know, they had change of seasons. We have change of seasons, just like Europe.
It must have been hard to, you know, to find, to know what was poisonous and what isn't poisonous, and what you can eat, what you can't eat. These are the first settlers in that area.
Yeah, for sure. And a lot of people, they attempted, like the French and the British were attempting to colonize the area. So they're constantly sending more boats and supplies, but I bet you the life expectancy was very low. Especially with like hostilities and, you know, with the Indian tribes and other things, like you're saying, I mean, be easy to eat some berries and die, right?
Yeah.
But people did have large families here, and the land was very arable. I mean, a lot of people think of Canada as a frozen tundra, but there's tons of arable land in Canada, just as there is in the U.S.
So they brought families with them? Do they bring families with them? Do they bring wives with them?
Yeah, I think – I know that Lost Colony of Roanoke was an entire community of men and women. But like I said, they didn't survive. As for the Acadians, they did bring, again, men and women. The French did. I'm not too familiar with Well, actually, I shouldn't say I'm not too familiar. The Mayflower, I'm sure, had a lot of families on it. And I don't think that was the only boat, but that's like the largest, I guess, grouping that came to Massachusetts in 1620 or so. But they did. They weren't here to just check it out. It wasn't just a bunch of soldiers on conquest or to find treasure. They were here to settle, right, these groups. for the long term.
Botanists and farmers and livestock men. I mean, did they bring over their own livestock? Do you know? Do they bring sheep and goats or
were they? I don't know. I assume they did. I would think that they did. Yeah. I can't say that I'm certain of it though.
Right. Sorry for interrupting. I just, you know, just trying to sort of imagine what it was like there to be the first settlers, you know, and to have this, you know, a ship would normally come with supplies, but because there's wars going on in Europe, you've got no ship arriving with supplies. You're just there on your own and you've just got to get down and survive and build a city. You know, I just find it amazing these colonists that, you know, in our race that just used to go out and find an uncolonized land and build it, and then we have this civilization that they built today. It amazes me, the strength of
character. Yeah, they must have had amazing skills, right?
Yeah, dedication as well. Mm-hmm. But yeah, sorry for interrupting there.
Oh no problem at all. I'm just to give an overview, like between that period of time and really up until the mid 18th century, you had a large population growth. Quebec wasn't a massive population growth, but Quebec, under the a man named Samuel de Champlain, he was like the governor of Quebec from, I think, about 1604 when he came. He established Quebec City in 1608. It's said that he crossed the ocean 20 times from France, and he explored all the way into the Great Lakes region and around the Great Lakes, around Lake Superior. I mean, this is thousands of miles, and down into now what is the United States, because in the southern portion of what's now Ontario, there's only a few places you can cross because it's basically a peninsula. It's not a you can cross at Niagara, you can cross at Detroit, and a few other places, but it's a little more complicated. And so he went right down into like Indiana and all that. New France was massive. It was all of that area, all the way down to Louisiana, around the Mississippi River. It was into Ohio, Indiana, south of that, Kentucky, all those areas that were not yet. I mean, it was sparsely populated, but they had control over that area. They sent trappers and hunters in those areas to, you know, get beaver pelts and skins and furs and everything else. The 13 colonies, the American colonies, were still on the East Coast at that point. This, after a matter of time, but the American colonies, mind you, were expanding in population at a much faster rate. I mean, I'll get to this, the foundation of the English in Canada. There are essentially colonists that were loyalists, but the French Indian War was a major turning point. I'd say the first major turning point in North America. So that was 1756 to 1763. So it coincided with the English and French War, which was essentially worldwide. A lot of people sometimes call it the First World War because the English and the French were fighting in Europe, North America, the Caribbean, and I believe North Africa. And this war was the Americans, the British, I should say, at that point, they were still the British. They had a couple million people. The French are said to have 60 to 100,000 in a much larger spread out territory. And they had better relations with the Indians, the Indian tribes. So that's why you have that name, right? The British fought a coalition of French and Indian tribes. The head, capital, I would say, was still Quebec City. And the main battle that decided that war was fought in 1759 in Quebec City. in a place called the Plains of Abraham, and it's still there to this day. And that's where the British, under General Wolfe, defeated the Marquis de Montcalm and the French. And it was called the Fall of New France. From that point on, I mean, the war continued. The war around the rest of the world was continuing And there, and the French did try to come back, but the British held them off. So that was considered the fall of New France, 1759. At that point, all of the, I'd say the upper class, the elites, most of the people that could actually read and so forth, and they all left and went back to France. And what was left in Quebec was the farmers and, you know, trappers and other guys that work with their hands.
So it was a hostile takeover, like a hostile takeover of the British. They've gone to war against the France, against the French, and they've kicked the French out. And then the British have taken over what was essentially New France. Is that correct?
Yeah, the British took it over, but they didn't necessarily, they didn't kick out anyone, but the elites chose to leave. Sorry. The peasants that were left behind were, what was created was called the Province of Quebec. And that was created in 1763. So they were allowed to live there, but they were under British rule. They could still speak their language and so on. They didn't try to assimilate them like that. Can you imagine the distance? You know, I mean, they had a lot of their own. The British still had a lot of area to conquer and discover and clear. I don't think that they really were concentrating too much on trying to assimilate everyone into British culture at that time. But the Treaty of Paris, which ended the 7 years war between the British and the French, basically changed a lot. Okay, there's something, a very important detail, which is the way that people traded money here in the British colonies. The Treaty of Paris in 1763 established that all of the land east of the Mississippi, all the way to the ocean, including the east coast of Canada, which is further east, south of the Hudson Bay, and all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico was now British. Okay, so although they allowed the French to stay, they were in control. And that treaty confirmed that the colonies could continue to print their own money, which in the past was the case, because when the colonies were chartered by Britain, they were chartered, allowing them to print their own money. The English pound was not the, of course, people would probably accept it, but it was not the prevalent currency. And there was a big change here when that occurred. You had a bill put forth in 1764, backed by the Rothschilds, which actually decided that no, the English pound was going to be used, and the colonies no longer had the right to print their own. It was called colonial script. And what they did was the British, I mean, at this time, the Rothschild banking conglomerate already controlled the Bank of England for a good 70 years at least. So they paid 50% of the value of the colonial script in pounds. So they basically cut the currency by 50%. And what happened in the British colonies was an immediate, massive unemployment. And, I think that's really what led. That was 1764.
Can you just explain a little bit more how that happened with the banks. So the colonies are printing their own money. And because of this treaty, this Paris, treaty, they're no longer able to print their own money. You've got, a British bank printing the money, why did they cut the money supply in half? Is that what you were saying by using sterling for 50%?
Right, because the British were using a central bank, just like many other European countries at that point. That bank was taken over by international bankers in the late 1690s under William of Orange. And they were able to, I guess, just pay out half of what the colonial script was actually worth.
Right. I've got you. So they devalued the currency as well.
Yes.
Got you.
They devalued it, yes. Right. By twofold, I guess, or half, yeah.
Okay. I understand.
And I have a quote here by Benjamin Franklin. He was asked around the early 1760s, why the colonies were so prosperous, and he referred to the colonial script. He said, that's an easy answer. It's because we issue our own money and we issue it in an equal amount as far as demand for trade and industry is. And when they would tax people, then that money would be retired. If they did tax you on, let's say, consumption taxes, because back then there were no property taxes or income taxes, they would retire that money. It would no longer be in circulation. And then they would, based on that, that would give them some knowledge as to how much more to produce. In other ways too, though, they would have information as to how industry is going, right, in trade.
So they had no usury, basically. They had no usury involved in this.
That's right. I don't think it was outlawed. But, I mean, as far as I know, back in the 1600s, Cotton Mather's a man that was, I think he was a Protestant minister. He popularized usury in terms of making it not something that Christians were afraid to do, but the state did not do that. These individual colonies didn't have usury, right? So you could borrow $1,000 from the farmer next door and pay him interest, and that was legal at that time in most of the colonies, as far as I know. I don't know about Pennsylvania though, but yeah. And he even said too, Benjamin Franklin, that's what led to the Revolutionary War, right? And you had the Battle of Lexington and Concord. And like I said, I'm going to get back to Canadian history, but because the British, it really does, it's a huge part of Canadian history. After the revolution, the loyalists that wanted to stay loyal to Britain, they basically left. Only around 10,000 came to what was then the province of Quebec. Okay, because the province of Quebec was modern day Quebec and Ontario. But the British feared that wasn't going to work too well because the French and English problem. But they started coming in the 1780s because the Revolutionary War ended in 1783. And there's only about 10,000 that came to Ontario. Others went to back to Great Britain. Some went to Nova Scotia and other places. But then, what they did, the British decided to split the province of Quebec between two names, Upper Canada and Lower Canada. And that was just based on elevation. So Upper Canada is now Ontario. Lower Canada looks exactly like it did, basically the same as it did. They both look exactly the same as they did, at that point in time, 1791, as they do today, except for that Ontario was then, a lot of the land up north was conquered and cleared. So it's a lot bigger than it was at this time. And so now you had for the first time, central Canada being populated by British people. And they had their own governor. They had a governor general. So at that point in time, they wanted to populate the area further. So they offered to Americans, the British government offered free lands. They would just cross over into southern Ontario and they'd get free land and some other benefits. And it's funny that actually more people came in that period of time between about 1791 and maybe that first 10 or 15 years than had come as loyalists to Ontario, or like I said, Upper Canada at that time. It was about 30,000 that came. And from 40,000 people initially in that time period, it quickly climbed. There was other immigration, but, you know, people had large families and the communities were a little more established. I guess they didn't have to worry too much about attacks from, Indians and hostilities any longer. Yeah. Sorry. Do you have any questions? I'm just trying to find my spot here.
No, just thinking about it. Okay. Not using usury was the natural default position, really. Up until about that time, up until about the 16th, 17th century, and then they made a law in Britain, the law for the abolishing of usury, and it basically legalized it and said you can have put interest on up to 10%. So what you were saying here is that they had a banking system where they would work out how much money the government needed to borrow, and that would be created, that would be the budget, that would be created, and then that would be paid back with taxes, and then that would be zeroed, and there would be no interest on that. And so it's fiat currency, basically. It's saying,
yes,
I want to borrow this, and the bank creates that money, and then you create the wealth, which pays for it, and then it gets zeroed because it's effectively saying, I'm going to create this amount of wealth, but we need some currency in order to help with purchasing the things that we need in order to create this wealth. And then it gets zeroed. And that way you don't end up with a huge debt like we have now, which can never be paid back because there's interest put on it all the time. There's interest put on it. And that interest that's put on it, it doesn't exist in the flotation of the money, in the money supply. It just doesn't exist in that money supply anywhere unless somebody else takes out another loan. So that's how come you end up with this huge debt. And there was
there's a perfect example of it during the Revolutionary War. So 1776, from 1776 till, from that point on, they decided to make the continental currency. So when they declared independence, they had their own currency, trying to again go back to what they had before 1764. But the way that was destroyed, okay, was that they counterfeited the Bank of England. Well, it was the international banks sent boatloads of counterfeit currency across the ocean and kept doing that until it lost pretty much all of its value. I mean, it went to the low point of 5,000 of these continental currencies for $1, one silver dollar. So it went down. It was worth like less than 1%. Nobody would take it. I think there was an expression for that. It's worth less than a continental. Right? And that was by 1781, it was completely destroyed. But they still ended up winning the revolution. But, you know, when they signed the Constitution in 1787, they stipulated that the U.S. can print its own money. And, I mean, it's still in there today, but not that they do. But another example of how the international banks got back in there was they created the first Bank of the United States in 1791. Now, this, you know, most of these leaders, like Washington, was opposed to this. So was Adams, Jefferson, and Madison. They fought against it. But the first Secretary of the Treasury, his name was Hamilton, Alexander Hamilton. And that was his real name was Alexander Levine, right? He was a Jew that was born in the Caribbean, but his father died and his mother remarried to a man named Hamilton. And he came into the U.S. as I think he was 15 years old when he came in. Anyway, he was basically a tool of these international banks that worked tirelessly to establish a new bank. He actually attempted in 1780 while the war was happening. He attempted to create the Bank of North America, he wanted to call it. But he ended up getting his way. They got their way. I'm thinking that Congress, you know, may have been compromised, but I bet you that conditions were not exactly the greatest in 1791 in the U.S. because of this problem with the currency. And so this, they were given a 20-year charter from 1791. And the reason I wanted to bring this up is because the War of 1812 began in 1812 because that charter was not renewed in 1811. At that time in 1811, when it expired, James Madison, who was was president, and he was one of the people that was most against the original 20-year charter. So when they made the second 20-year charter, or they wanted to do the second 20-year charter, it was refused. And Congress, too, refused it. So he wasn't alone. And, of course, that brought on the War of 1812, which lasted for 3 years with the British fighting the Americans.
And just stop there a second. So this bank that was given that 20-year charter, were they using usury?
Yes. It basically operated in the same way that the Federal Reserve operates today. Right.
So that was a rebellion against. Because they weren't given the charter, they sowed the seeds of rebellion and sponsored this 1812 war, or encouraged.
Yeah, them. And they brought a lot of British troops here, right, to Quebec and Ontario. Okay, at that time, it's still Upper and Lower Canada, to defend because the Americans were the first to attack. And there was a battle. The first battle, I believe, was the Battle of Queenston Heights. It's actually near where I grew up, and I've been there. It was there was a small gathering of soldiers, mostly militiamen. I said that they sent a lot of soldiers. They did later in the second part of the war. But in the first part of the war, the British were fighting the Napoleonic Wars in Europe. So they didn't have the manpower to send over. And it was mostly Canadian militia and the British troops that were already here. So the Americans attacked first because they had a good chance to win, basically. They failed at the Battle of Queenston Heights, but eventually they did get in and they got as far as Stony Creek, which is another 30 miles up the road, and then to York, which is today Toronto, which was the capital at that time of Upper Canada. And there was I think they blew up the refinery, munitions depot there. So they had some successes, but as Napoleon lost and the British started sending more troops here, they were repelled. And the British actually ended up going right down to Washington, as far as Washington. They burned the White House. President Madison had to leave temporarily. It was only like a one-night thing, him and some of his staff, to a smaller town and come back. They tried to go all the way down to New Orleans. I believe that they were stopped by, they were being stopped before they could take New Orleans is attributed to the Kentucky sharpshooters. I don't know, they weren't the only people there, but Kentucky sharpshooters were known as the best shooters in North America, probably the world. I mean, I think they still are. But so it was a terrible war. And the result of it was essentially, even though a lot of people don't want to say it, the British pretty much won because they got their second charter in 1816. And Madison had to agree to it, right? And even he was still president. So again, they were so devastated at that point. I don't think they had a choice, or maybe that's how they felt anyhow.
Was it admitted that this is what the war was about? It was about the Banks Charter, or did they have some other reason that they were trying to give for it?
No, I've learned some of this from Clifton Emmaheiser, right? One of his broadcasts, I looked into it. I've never heard anyone else say this before. That was about a year or two ago. But it's generally, I don't even know what they say the war was about. It's kind of the war that nobody really knows what it's like. The Canadians think, well, the Americans were being jerks and they wanted to take our land and we fought back. That's kind of the way it is. But there was a lot more to it, obviously. It's not really talked about. And so, at this time, so what was happening in Ontario or Upper Canada was the city of Toronto was being built. City of Hamilton was being built. All these things happened after the War of 1812. And before I get to Confederation, which is when Canada was created as a separate sovereign nation, a self-ruling nation in 1867. Again, I have to bring up the major thing was that 20-year charter was not going to be renewed again, this time by Andrew Jackson, because from 1816, it was to last to 1836. He was president. He began his first term saying right away that he wants to destroy the banks because of what they're doing. And he had a lot of support, but there was resistance, but he did succeed. And then there was that period of time. So I think it was even before 1836 that he basically destroyed it. But there was a panic. So what the bankers fought back, of course, they created a financial panic. It's called the Panic of 1837. And that affected Canada because, there was a lot of trade at that time between the U.S. and Canada. And it ended up being a rebellion here in Upper Canada. It's called the Upper Canada Rebellion of 1837, which began and was actually led by, there was a lot of leaders, but the mayor, the first mayor of the city of Toronto, as it was renamed Toronto from York in 1834. He was he led the campaign. They essentially wanted to do the same sort of thing that Andrew Jackson stood for, although it's not really talked a lot about from what I've seen. But everything, they wanted to become a republic. They wanted to break away from Britain. And that was eventually put down. The rebellion didn't work. There was also a rebellion in 1838, the following year, in Lower Canada. So the French were rebelling too, and they wanted a republic. He was exiled at one point, sort of. He found some small island, him and some of his him and some of his supporters, I guess. They found a small island somewhere between U.S. and Canada on the Niagara River, and actually declared the Republic of Canada, but it didn't last long. He was exiled for about 15 years, but he did end up returning. But that sentiment was what kind of drove Canada to become a self-governing nation, because from 1837 to 1867, I think that the British might have feared that the same thing might start happening here, that they might have a war losing Canada. But I didn't really read up a lot on it. That's a general sentiment. I couldn't tell you too many details, but there were a couple of acts passed by British Parliament appeasing the rebels.
And what happened with the what happened with the banks that on the next charter then after the next 20 years?
Well, they didn't get another charter after after Jackson, as far as I know, and that was probably the greatest period of prosperity in the U.S. as far as the common people from that period of time up to 1764, when they lost their colonial script, and it lasted up till the Civil War, basically. So 1837 to 1860. So I know a lot of people.
I'm getting a bit confused with the time there. I thought you were saying we were in the 18th century, 19th century rather, 1836 or 1860 or something like that. And then we had the 20-year charter was taking us up to about 1860.
No, it was from – okay, the first one was 1791 till 1811.
Right.
Then the war was fought and they got their second 20-year charter in 1816 till 1836.
Right.
Okay, so – Jackson was able to stop that, a renewal of the charter. There was no international charter between the from 1836 till sorry, not international, but there was no banking charter from 1836 to 1865, as far
right.
as I know.
Right. So you had that 30 years, and that was a 30 years of prosperity and growth and building.
Yeah. And I mean, they expanded all the way to the Pacific Ocean. They didn't have a debt, I believe, or it was either they didn't have a national debt for the first time under by the time of the end of Jackson's reign. And the next two, I think it was Van Buren after him and James K. Polk, they went all the way to the West Coast, right? They were able to expand and take a lot of land, including California. They really achieved a lot in those years too. But the books, like the balance books for the federal government were better than they have ever been. They have never been that good since then either. So up here, what was happening was, so after those rebellions, like I said, I think that the British must have had some fear that there would be a problem. It would be really difficult for them. At this point, Canada had probably a few million people, maybe 1-2 million. Technology had made it a lot more difficult to come and conquer it. If there was a rebellion, I don't know if there was really a will to do that anyhow in Britain. So Canada became its own country in 1867. At that time, it was only 4 provinces. Today, it's 10. There was Ontario. So Upper Canada was renamed Ontario. Lower Canada was Quebec once again. Nova Scotia and New Brunswick. So again, the area where the Acadians were. And it began to expand west, especially west and north. So you had the prairie provinces, which are today Manitoba, Saskatchewan, Alberta, And also before this, so around the 1840s, Vancouver, the British port of Vancouver, was settled on the West Coast. And they built a national railway to connect the country for trade and for protection in case of time of war, so they could move soldiers around and supplies and so on. And so that railway really, you know, I mean, it's unbelievably long, right? Canada is a lot wider than the U.S. because it kind of juts out. It's like, I don't know, 5,000 miles long. That I think it's even more than that, the railroad itself, because it has to wind around the Great Lakes, go down into the populated area of southern Ontario, and then go back up and so on. So it must have taken a long time to build that. And they offered, again, free land to a lot of immigrants. People from Europe came in large numbers to settle the farmland in the prairies, like the Ukraine. For example, there's still a large population of Ukrainians to this day, people of descent, Ukrainian descent in that area. And other people started coming from Scotland, Ireland. During the potato famine, a lot came here. So things really started to take off for Canada. It seems like that was one of the best times, actually, because it was relative peace between 1867. It was growth, and between then and 1914, Canada also had its own separate bank. It was not a it was not governed by the international banks at that time. That happened a lot later. It actually happened a lot later than the Federal Reserve in the U.S. too. But I don't know if I want to jump that far into history.
I'm just thinking about the, you know, what a big change having that railway line must have made. I mean, we take it for granted today that we have rail that connects everything up. But it was a really big thing to start connecting up these areas that have been colonized. The Cape to Cairo railway in Africa was a huge thing. And I can imagine that connecting up these various parts of Canada so that they were connected and you could get, you know, pelts or logs or whatever it is that you needed from the other part of Canada, you could now suddenly get it, or you could travel there as well. You know, it must have made a huge difference to them just to be able to transport whatever it is that they needed from one part to another, and also then get a sense of it being your own country, and these are your own people, sort of nation building, because it's all connected up. Whereas before it would have been, you know, disparate settlements, but now it's connected. Don't you think?
Yes, absolutely. And you could take advantage of all those natural resources that were thousands of miles away from each other. Like if you had coal in Alberta, you could bring it to Quebec and Ontario and the East Coast and vice versa. So I think it was the most important thing that really kept Canada together, because at the end of the Civil War, you got to keep in mind that the U.S. had a large standing army, and Canada was not yet connected by this railway. They probably had a lot of soldiers that were willing to fight if they said, let's go to Canada. And that was one of the concerns when they did Confederation, when it was created. So militarily, too, it obviously helped. I don't know. Do you want to talk about the 20th century or?
Yeah, well, go on from there. I mean, so what we got up to? We got up to about the time of the First World War, haven't we? So did Canada take part in that? Were they fighting on the side of the British? Because your monarch is the same as the British monarch. So Canada must have been given, it was a separate country, but at the same time, it's still got a link with Britain, hasn't it? So what's that?
Yeah, Canada was there right away, right? Right as soon as the war broke out. 1914, although there were some people in Quebec that did not want to fight, but English Canada was there. They were a large Canada actually had a pretty decent navy in World War One, because there was a massive incident here, a huge explosion around 10 or 12 years previous to the war, where a navy ship that had a bunch of munitions on it exploded and destroyed half of the city of Halifax in Nova Scotia, which is the largest city there. And after that, under the Prime Minister Wilfrid Laurier, they decided to really get, you know, make a proper navy. And within a short period of time, I believe that Canada had I think it was the fourth or fifth largest navy at one point in the Western Hemisphere. Of course, that changed after. There wasn't so much a desire for it after World War One. But yeah, they were there. They fought in that war. Some notable people in the war I can mention is, I think his name was George Smith. Sorry if I'm wrong on the name, but he was the man who shot down the Red Baron, actually, the great World War One ace pilot. Which, of course, I'm not really a big fan of all these wars with white nations. But Canadians were known to be really good soldiers. One thing that there was said about them was that they didn't salute often enough, they didn't shave often enough, and they drank too much. But they're known as really gritty soldiers. I guess that comes from growing up in an area that's a little more difficult terrain and a harder place to live year round, anyhow.
What happened? What happened with the banks then? Because when did we get the Federal Reserve in America? What date was that?
That was 1913.
Right. And you say that
they did have. Sorry, go on.
I was going to say you said that didn't happen in Canada until much later.
Yeah, it was really under Pierre Trudeau, right? So it's Justin Trudeau's father who was prime minister from 1968 to 1984, with a brief spell where he wasn't prime minister for like 3 months because there was a parliamentary shuffle. But he was he really was the one who took Canada in a very far leftist direction in many aspects and many areas of society. He was very friendly with Cuba and Fidel Castro. He was friendly with China.
I think his wife was friendly with Fidel Castro, wasn't she?
Yeah. Yeah, she was actually friends with Fidel, Trudeau, supposedly, before she knew Pierre, right? So.
Right, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it is a stunning resemblance, isn't it, between Justin Trudeau and Fidel Castro at a certain stage
in
Castro's
amazing
life.
Yeah, it is. I couldn't prove it, but I wouldn't doubt that, you know, it could be his son. But, another thing, too, that Pierre Elliott Trudeau was, he nationalized a lot of the fuel. He took away our property rights. So in Canada, we don't own, because I think it was like 1970 or so, one of the first things he did, we don't own anything under the land that we own. We only own the surface. So if I own, 1,000 acres somewhere, I only own the surface. If there's anything valuable underneath there, like oil or whatever, then it's the federal government's property now. And what really sucks about that is they'll actually go out to people's land when they discover that something's on it. And they'll say, look, we're going to set up this thing and drill here. And that's going to totally ruin your farm and everything. But we're willing to give you this nominal amount. This nominal amount would be like something like, $100,000, where meanwhile you probably have tens of millions of dollars of oil. And you really don't have any bargaining power. You can either take the 100 grand or don't take it. They're still going to drill there because it's theirs, you know, and that will ruin the property. I mean, in terms of the value of your own home. So it's really the things he did in such a short period of time were amazing. He ran up Canada's debt. He gave away the Federal Bank of Canada to the international bankers. A lot of people were kind of asleep during this because Canada was living such a high quality of lifestyle from the 60s, 70s, and 80s. Like 70s and 80s here were like, it was an unbelievable amount of immigration that we were having because everyone wanted to live here because it was so easy. The taxes were low, all sorts of taxes. Fees were low. The dollar was fairly strong. There was tons of work in any field you wanted. But of course, that policy didn't really last very long, right? By the 1990s, that all started crashing. Not that Canada doesn't have a decent economy relative to other countries, but I mean, it's he ran up the debt and the deficits, and then they had to start taxing us. And then we had an 8% national sales tax, which is not just on goods, but it's also on services. So, you can't really get away from it. Our income taxes keep going through the roof, capital gains taxes, property taxes in every community. That's an unfortunate period of time that we had that guy for 15 years. But It's a tough hole to get out of.
So he was the one that changed the bank from it being an independent bank to being part of the central banking system, the international banking system. That's relatively late, isn't it? 1960 or whatever it is. I mean, they must have been linked up to it in some way before then, because otherwise there'd have been another war, surely.
Yeah, sorry, it was. But I think that it was 50% owned by the people of Canada. Okay, so we still had half of the ownership, whereas he gave away that other half.
Because, I mean, we see when Gaddafi wanted to have a separate bank, we saw what happened to him. Syria had a separate bank. Iran has a separate bank. North Korea has a separate bank. You know, all these countries have banks that are owned by the people. They're still in the same way that the banks were before this charter came in, before this Rothschild banking system came in. There are still parts of the world that have the original banking system, and you know, the rest of the world goes to war against them. So Canada must have been part of the system in some way. I guess when it was handed over to the Canadians by Britain. Could you go into a bit more detail on that? Because Canada is a separate country, but it still has the British Queen as the monarch, and it still has something to do with Britain. So it's not a dominion anymore. It's not a dependency, is it? What is it?
Well, it has a strange, it's sort of like Australia, I think, that the Queen or the monarch is really a symbolic figure. They don't have any power in terms of changing law. They essentially sign whatever is presented to them to sign if it's passed in Parliament. And then there's another position which is called the Governor General. And technically, the Governor General is the Queen's representative or the monarch's representative, and they are the head of state here. They're also commander-in-chief of the armed forces, but that role doesn't have any power either. It's a symbolic or nominal role. You're the governor general, just like when there was a governor general in Upper Canada back in the day, type of thing. And that guy did have some power, but they don't have any power. So, and then we have a Senate too. The system's really, it needs to be overhauled. The Senate doesn't have any real power neither. It's an appointee position Senate. You're appointed for life. They rubber stamp any bill that comes to them, although they can hold up these bills for like a year or a year and a half. They don't really have any of their own power.
Sounds a bit like the House of Lords. Sounds a bit like the House of Lords in Britain. You got the House of Commons and the House of Lords. And the House of Lords can hold things up, or they can, but most of the time they just sort of rubber stamp it. And the Queen is constitutional monarch, so she just rubber stamps things. And obviously, this Governor General is her representative in Canada, so he does the rubber stamping.
Yeah, I think that I don't know too much about the British system, but I know that our system is based on it. They kind of replicated it. So I don't know what the difference is, but. Yeah, I guess you guys have a in the House of Lords, are they appointed for life or is it hereditary?
Yeah, it's hereditary, and they make people into lords as well, and then they've got it for life, and they're supposed to show up there and they get paid for showing up there. I think it was better when it was hereditary, really, because you had people that knew that that's what they were going to do from the minute that they were born, and they were prepared for that, they were groomed for that to be a lord and do what a lord does, rather than people being made into lords nowadays. They just get made into them. I think it was better like that. If you're going to have a system where you're going to have people that are voted in one house, and then in the other house you have bishops and lords and landed gentry and people that have been used to ruling for generations in their family, so you get the best of both worlds then. I think that I wouldn't want to do away with the House of Lords. It's just a shame that we don't have, enough of a good aristocracy left If we had a better aristocracy, it would be even better. But there's one, I think Lord Pearson, I think his name is, and he was the UKIP Lord, and he's pretty good. There's a couple of them that are good, but not like it used to be. The aristocracy is really corrupted now, but they used to take an interest and they used to care about the people. The kings used to care about the people. So it's basically a democracy that you've got there. And what's the multiculturalism like? Because when I looked on the Wikipedia page, it said that you were about 70%, I think it was, 70% white, and lots of Asians there, but only about 3% black. So it looks like you've got lots of Chinese there from what I was looking at.
Yeah, there is a lot. Of course, it's always the big cities. Vancouver has a lot of Asians. Toronto does too. But they are everywhere else. I mean, any sizable city. But I think that the population of Canada is probably about 2/3 white right now. It's dropping very quickly. And also a lot of the people that claim to be white on the census form, it's really your choice. And I think that they include some other groups as white that shouldn't be included. I know that happens in the U.S. too. I know it happens here. But Canada is a very urban population. Most of the country is in and around cities that are larger than, let's say, 500,000 people. There aren't a lot of cities larger than 500,000, but that's where most of the population is. And then the rest of it is, you know, mostly small towns. You'll have the odd city of 50 or 100,000 people here and there. But it's just so spread out, you know.
And what's the French colony? What's Quebec like? Does it see itself? Do the French see themselves as a part of Canada, or do they see themselves as separate? I mean, I would imagine that they would have more of a sense of identity, of a national identity, because they speak a different language and have a slightly different culture. I would imagine that, you know, that they were more nationalist minded than the rest of Canada. But how do they fit in?
Yeah, they were. They still are, I would say, to some degree, but they had a referendum here in 1980. So after the 1960s, they became more and more nationalist-minded. And in 1980, they had a referendum to separate from Canada. I think they lost 60% to 40%. Then there was another referendum in 1995, and that one was 51% to stay, 49% to leave. And when that happened, the federal government changed the rules for referendums, saying that you'd have to have 2/3 of the vote. Okay, now you would think that in order to separate, let's say, but you would think that that would indicate from 1980 to 1995 that Quebec nationalism was growing. And I think it was until that point. But there was a major change in the last 20 years. And I think a lot of it has to do with the influx of refugees and just the way that society in general is going all over Western nations, and I guess the whole world at this point, that they now a lot of younger people, or people probably my age at this point, I'm 45, they view themselves as a member of a planet, you know, planet Earth, and this big, we're all together, and it doesn't really matter where you're from. I think that's more common. People are getting more left leaning because I don't think Quebec nationalism, those parties do terrible in the polls, and they have for the last 20 years.
It sounds a bit like it's like Scotland, you know, having these referendums and wanting to have referendums, and the referendums being pretty close. I mean, years ago, centuries ago, you would have had to have had a unanimous vote to do something like that. Everybody would have to agree. That's the way it used to be in Britain, looking at the sort of pre-Saxon times, probably in the Saxon times as well. Everybody would have to agree on something. The idea that somebody wouldn't agree, you didn't have a unanimous decision. Well, you couldn't make that decision then. You had to convince the person that didn't want to do it that he did want to do it, so that everybody agreed, so that you could all move on in the direction that you wanted to. And it's democracy that pits us against one another, doesn't it? When you say, well, we'll just allow the majority, because the minority are always going to be losing out there, aren't they?
Yeah, it splits everybody up into their own little factions, really, is what it does.
We need to be united. Well, that's been really interesting, Zee. I'm really glad you came on and told us about that. That's a lot of food for thought there about the banking system. So thank you very much for coming on. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I will be back next week, hopefully with Dennis Wise. And until then, I hope you all have a great weekend ahead of you.